You're listening to Now I've Heard Everything, conversations with the icons of our time.
I began to hear some of the same stories that I would give the judges when I would be arrested, some of the same excuses that I would give.
TV's Judge Greg Mathis, today on Now I've Heard Everything. I'm Bill Thompson. Greg Mathis was a juvenile delinquent. Growing up in rough Detroit neighborhoods, he fell in with the wrong crowd and was actually arrested several times before he was even 17. But when he reached a critical turning point, Mathis was able to turn his life around. He got his GED. He went to college and got a bachelor's degree. He went to law school and got a law degree. Then he passed the bar. But he faced even more obstacles on his way to becoming a popular TV courtroom personality. In fact, he's so popular, only Judge Judy has been on the air longer. In 2002, Greg Mathis wrote his autobiography, a book called Inner City Miracle. He and I met that fall to talk about the book. So here now, from 2002, Judge Greg Mathis.
I really never wanted to disclose all the bad skeletons in my closet, quite frankly. I don't know many people who would.
True.
The fact is, in 1995, when I ran for judge in Detroit, the nature of politics, as I call it, my opponents dug up my criminal background, my juvenile delinquent background, and gave it to the news media in an attempt to destroy my campaign. And that's how the public found out about my past as a troubled youth. And it backfired, however, and Detroiters elected me the youngest judge in Michigan history because they thought it was a success story. And indeed, the national news media thought it was and gave me a little play on the election day. I had a report on CNN, BET, USA Today. And then later, Hollywood came calling. The agents and the producers wanted to make a movie on my life, and because they thought it would be good television, if you would. They wanted to make a television movie. And so while they were pitching that television movie, however, the Warner Brothers studio said, well, we'd like this guy to be a television judge. How about that? And so what was to be a movie turned into the Judge Mathis television court show. And then when I got on the show, I did want the public to know my inspirational story. So I asked if Warner Brothers would include it as part of the introduction to the show, because by that time I had found that it was inspirational to young people and to parents who are raising young people alone in many instances. And so it was then that I began to get letters and calls from people saying, please write a book about your experiences so that it can be an inspiration. And that's why I wrote it.
I'm guessing this has to have made you a better judge, because you're up there. You've heard all the excuses before.
Probably been there and done that.
Yeah, you probably used some of those excuses at some point or another in your life, and you can cut through the BS and say, all right, come on, I'm not buying that.
Right. That's exactly what happened. Time I got on the bench in Detroit, I began to see and hear some of the same stories that I would give the judges when I would be arrested, or see and hear some of the same excuses that I would give. And the fact is, I know that it takes tough love and inspirational justice. And that's the type of justice that I adjudicate in my courtroom every day. And that's what I did as a 36th District Court judge in Detroit for 5 years when I sat there.
I'm guessing you tell a lot of those people that this is a choice that they've made. You've made choices in your life, and you've gone in one direction. Other people make different choices given the same circumstances, and they go off in a different direction.
Absolutely. Not only do I talk about the choices, because so oftentimes people who come from impoverished, drug and crime infested neighborhoods, they try and point the finger and blame others and blame their obstacles for their current circumstance. So not only do I talk about the choices that you have to control your own destiny, I talk about fighting against the obstacles that would otherwise destroy you and limit your opportunity. Yes, we know that poverty exists and that poverty can in many instances limit your opportunity because when you're in an impoverished community, you're going to poor schools provide poor education, But you have to fight back against it and educate yourself despite the circumstance. And yes, there's racism and discrimination in America mm-hmm. still to a certain extent, but you can't let that consume you. You have to fight back and overcome that as well. And so that's what I try and instill in both the people who come before me in my courtroom and like to blame their circumstance and situation on their obstacles and on their environment. And as well, that's what I talk about in the book.
But how do you get past the rage and resentment of being in the circumstances like you were just describing?
You put down your gun and pick up your books. That's what I tell them. And that's what I had to do, quite frankly, Bill. On my last encounter with the law at age 17, I was arrested for carrying a gun and sat in jail for 6 months. Yes, I was internalizing the anger and the pain of rejection and racism and alienation and poverty and all the things that I had grown up in. But on the other hand, I had to determine that, okay, now what? Those things exist. So now what? Am I going to allow them to destroy me, or am I going to put down my gun and pick up my book and empower myself to become successful and then help in fighting back against poverty, help to fight back against those things that I thought were holding me back?
And those things would have destroyed you, wouldn't they? I mean, you would have died young probably, wouldn't you?
Either that or I would have been like 95% of my other friends. In prison or on drugs.
Dying slowly.
Absolutely.
Oh, yep. Man. And all the choices, all the places, all the crossroads you came to, all the forks in the road, all the, because it's not just one momentous decision. Today, you know, I've decided I will be. Because after that, it's not a smooth, wide, flat, well-lit road. It's got a lot of bumps and curves in it, and you're faced with choices every day to go back to the old way or to take a little shortcut here and there and things like that. You've got choices all the time to make.
Absolutely. And as I indicate in my book, it's not even an easy transition going from a street youth to a college student or to a professional as it was with me. My first couple of years in college, I was still kind of going through that transition and still trying to strengthen myself against the peer pressure, still trying to hustle my way a little through college. And so it took a couple of years to make that transition into mainstream society. But the one thing I didn't do is I never gave up, Bill. For example, even after I'd gotten my GED, my bachelor's degree, and my law degree, the state bar withheld my law license for 3 years after I'd passed the bar exam because of my juvenile delinquent record. Now, if any time one were to consider giving up and running back to the street, that would have been the time. But I didn't do that. I didn't run to the drug house to try and smoke my problems away. I didn't run to the liquor store and try and drink them away. Didn't run home and beat my wife out of frustration. Instead, I fought back until I won my right to practice law 3 years later at the Michigan Supreme Court. Didn't let them stop me. Kept fighting back until I won. And that's, once again, that's what we must do.
And one victory builds to the next, and that builds to the next, and it gives you more confidence. Pretty soon, you're firmly on that track.
2 years later, when I ran for judge, is when they came at me again with my criminal background, exposing it to the media. Fought that victory and won again.
Then they come to you with a contract, and you looked at this contract and said, no, I think this could be even better, and you won again. But again, we want to let people know, I mean, that this is not, I mean, people assume, especially once Hollywood gets involved and they put their spin on it, that things are perfectly rosy for you, that even now that you don't have any choices to make, that even now life must be sweet for you.
Bill, on the way to the studio to interview with you, I was arguing with three different power brokers about how I should control my own life and how, whether I should have to work 16 hours a day without food or water, which is slavery, or whether I could get a 2-hour break in between to eat some food, maybe.
Wait, so, you want to eat?
Right. But the fact is, the struggle continues at every level of society. There's a struggle for all of us, you, myself, everyone.
After this short break, Greg Mathis explains the crucial role his mother played in his life.
Start your day with Now I've Heard Everything.
We post new episodes every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 5 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time.
Subscribe now so you'll have something fresh to listen to and get your day going.
Now back to my 2002 conversation with Judge Greg Mathis.
I have had in the last couple of years, recently, in the 21st century now, I've had successful African-American authors come to me in suit and tie, as you have just now, to tell me that on their way to my studio, they were stopped by a police officer for driving while black.
Yep.
This happens in the 21st century to successful people. Now, you have a choice in that particular situation to make. You have a choice of whether you're going to make a fuss, make a, you know, stand up for your rights, just let it go and say, yes, I've gone to the studio. What do you do?
Yeah, certainly you don't get angry and provoke an incident that would result in police brutality.
Yikes.
So that's one choice. The other choice is to maintain your composure and get the officer's name and then file a formal complaint, follow up with it, file that same complaint with organizations that fight against racial profiling and police misconduct, NAACP namely and others, and then continue to empower yourself so that you can have a positive effect on the root causes of such a thing, because the root cause of racial profiling and other acts of prejudice is typically a result of racial stereotyping. People being convinced that another group of people, because they're different from them, because they assume they are a certain type of person, they mistreat them. Whether it's the Latino who's recently immigrated to the U.S. who's mistreated because we view him as some person who shouldn't be here and who's taking the jobs of the natural or of the born citizen, or whether it's an immigrant from the Mideast who we want to suspect might be dealing in terrorism, or whether it's the black street youth who we have a picture of as a gangster or a thug. These are all negative and false stereotypes that we use in determining how we're going to treat or mistreat people. And the way to change that is to empower yourselves if you are a member of a class that is usually victimized in that way. Empower yourselves to provide that positive image so that next time they stop you, they'll be asking for an autograph.
That's right. Now, let me go in a little bit different direction for a moment. This book is in many ways a great tribute to your mother, isn't it?
Absolutely. My mother was the most phenomenal woman I've ever heard of, less known. The fact is, my mom raised four boys in the toughest housing projects in Detroit alone, without the help of any man. Her and my dad divorced at age when I was 1 year old, and my dad never played a role in my life other than, say, a few weeks of an attempt to straighten me out, and that backfired when he hooked me up with some more criminals. But the fact is, she raised four boys alone, was never on welfare, worked midnights as a nurse's aide, cleaning the bedpans for the sick and the elderly from 10 p.m. to 7 a.m., came home a couple of hours and went to sleep, then woke up at noon and went to clean houses for rich folks in the suburbs as a housekeeper. Got back at 4 p.m., took a couple of hours nap after fixing dinner and getting her boys to do their homework, got back up and went to her midnight shift. That was the shift, that was the work ethic that she had. And so that is one of the reasons, of course, we had little supervision living in a tough drug and crime-infested hostile housing projects. But she knew what many parents need to know, and that is that if you invest in your child's spirituality and education on the front side of life, you won't have to worry about the judge going up their backside so much or the teacher or whomever. Because indeed, even though she wasn't there to supervise very much these four boys because she had to work, the times that she was there, Bill, we engaged in prayer in our household twice a day. She required me and my brothers to attend church three times a week. The 2 days a week that she was off, she took us to church. And the third day, she had the head deacon come pick us up and take us to church. Then, of course, she invested in my church school, tuition. She paid $120 a month for me to go to the church school in grades 1 through 6, was only paying $80 a month for rent. Meaning, that's right. Meaning that she believed so much in her faith and in a quality education that she sacrificed our living conditions, knowing that if she invested in us early on, it would pay off later in life. So even though I fell to the peer pressure temporarily, when my wake-up call came, I knew how to answer it. And it was because that great woman knew how to invest in those four boys early in life.
And you sound like a guy who knows that she's still looking over your shoulder.
Absolutely. Let me add that one of the things I try and convey in this book is that we must invest in educating our young people just as much as we're investing in incarcerating our young people. And to bring that point home, Bill, you know, it costs taxpayers $35,000 for me to stay in jail for the 6 months at age 17. 1 year later, taxpayers had to foot the bill for me to go to college because I had no parents. My mother had died by then. When the taxpayers had to pay for me to go to college, they had to pay only $8,000 a year. $35,000 a year to keep me in jail for 6 months. $8,000 for an entire year at Eastern Michigan University. It's more cost efficient for us to invest in educating our youth than incarcerating our youth. Yes, if they're violent criminals, take them off the street. But for first-time nonviolent offenders, we must mandate that they get an education and we must invest in it. That's what brought me through, and that's the message I try and convey in this book.
Greg Mathis will be 64 in April. He's still on the air every week on a show called Mathis Family Matters. Now, you can get a copy of Inner City Miracle by Greg Mathis by tapping the link in our show notes or by going to our website, heardeverything.com. We may earn an Amazon commission if you make a purchase. Now, while you're at heardeverything.com, don't miss my 2002 interview with the famed attorney Johnny Cochran.
When I was 11 years old, I wanted to be a lawyer. And as I think back, I can only tell you that I love to convince, to persuade, to argue. Because I didn't really know much about any lawyers until high school.
And my 1990 conversation with another man who had a very strong mother when he was growing up and who guided him through the trials and tribulations of life. And he went on to become a great success, Dr. Ben Carson.
The thing that really brought it into focus was the Bender twins, because that's when people started saying, isn't that the same guy? Isn't that the guy who did this? Isn't that the guy? And all of a sudden, this tag of miracle worker and all these things started being applied to me, which of course is absolutely not true. There's no way that I can work a miracle.
And of course, we post new episodes of Now I've Heard Everything every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And you know where you can find us, right here, everywhere you listen to podcasts. And thank you so much for listening. Next time on Now I've Heard Everything, the man who was at the center of the U.S.-Soviet relationship for decades saw the end of the Cold War and wrote a book about it. My 2004 interview with the former U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union, Jack Matlock.
Both he and Gorbachev felt that both countries won the Cold War in that they liberated themselves from the arms race, from the threats, and from the cost of it.
That's next time on Now I've Heard Everything. I'm Bill Thompson.